look out the window at the road. It's all different today. A little over 2,700 years ago, the Neo-Assyrian Empire, is what it's known as, was making some great strides in gaining territory in the Middle East. And they attacked and harassed their neighbors. They weren't the nicest of people, if you know anything about the Assyrians, the Assyrian Empire. They conquered and exacted tribute from everybody in their path. And the nations of Israel and Judah were not exempt at all from, their designs on the area. Now, Isaiah was the prophet in Judah, or one of the prophets in Judah at the time, and he seemed to be connected to the royal court, so he had access to the king, so forth, and king's advisors. And his prophecies that we have in the Bible record some of that. And in fact, the book that contains those prophecies is one of the longest books in the Bible, 66 chapters there in Isaiah. And it contains warnings to Judah and Israel, and also accounts of the judgment of many of the nations that surround, that were around, and the empires that were around Israel and Judah at the time. The book of Isaiah is the most quoted book in the New Testament, the most quoted Hebrew book in the New Testament. Most of us will be turning to it probably quite often here in a few weeks when we go to keep the fall festivals. There's a lot in the book of Isaiah that we like to turn to at this time of year. And today I'd like to just focus on one chapter of the book, and it doesn't have to do with the Messianic kingdom. It's just something different. I'm going to talk about Isaiah 28, and that's where we're going to go. And if you want to turn there, you can turn there, because that's probably the only place we're going to go. I don't have an intention of going anywhere else anyway. Maybe one other chapter in Isaiah or two. But Isaiah 28 comes after 15 chapters of that contain God's judgment on the nations around, you know, Moab and Jordan and, you know whatever, all the lands around there. And in chapter 28, the focus is not on them anymore. The focus switches to be on Judah in particular, and Judah and Israel together. And chapter 28 concerns events that were to be in the very near future, or maybe some of them. It's hard to tell the exact dates, and people argue about it one way or the other, but perhaps the what happened in Israel had already happened. What's described as happening in Israel had already happened, but it hadn't been in Judah yet. Assyria was not going to be stopped. So Israel and maybe had already felt their wrath, and Judah was going to be feeling it. Judah became a vassal state for years before they were conquered. And Isaiah was warning Judah's leaders not to trust in themselves, not to make the same mistakes that Israel's leaders had made, not to trust in foreign alliances, but to trust God. So let's just dig into chapter 28 to understand it better. And one of the reasons, one of the motivations for doing this is because there are several scriptures in Isaiah 28 that are very familiar to us. And you'll recognize them when we get there if you don't already know what they are. So it would, I think, be educational. It was good for me, and I hope it will be good for you, to see what these scriptures mean in their context. Sometimes we just lift them out, you know, and say, oh, we use this scripture or use that scripture. But let's find out what they meant to Isaiah, what they meant to the people he was talking to. And, and we'll have a better understanding of those verses. So let's start in Isaiah 28, verse 1. We'll start right at the beginning. I've got the King James up here. I may turn to that from time to time, but I've also, I'll be reading in the New American Standard. Woe, it says in verse 1, woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim, and to the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley of those who are overcome with wine. By the way, this is written in some kind of a Hebrew poetic style. I'm not an expert on that, but we'll see something a little later. But if you look at it, you've got the New King James. It's probably written in a verse format. New American Standard is written that way, so it's got a structure to it, and we'll be able to learn a little bit from that structure as we go. It says, "Woe to the proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim." So we're talking about the pride of Ephraim. Now, who's Ephraim? Well, Ephraim was a tribe of Israel, but in this case, and in many cases in the Bible, since Ephraim was the largest, or it came to be like the largest and most populous of the tribe, so it stood for, and I think, I think the capital of Samaria was in Ephraim. I should have looked that up. Maybe some of you know. but Ephraim, as that particular tribe, came to be to stand for and be a symbol that stood for the entire nation of Israel. When I say entire nation, we're talking about after it split into a north and south, and there were 10 tribes up north, and then Judah and remnants of Simeon and Benjamin and so forth down the south. So when it says Ephraim, it's talking about the 10 northern tribes, which by this time, by the time Isaiah had written this, they either had already been conquered or they were going to be conquered very soon, and they were already being harassed by the Assyrians. And again, it just depends on where and how you date this, and I don't know the answer, and it doesn't change anything I'm going to say one way or the other, whether it had already happened or not. And it says, woe to them. This is the lead. You know, who's woe? Woe to the leaders of Israel. Why? Well, the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley. Now, Samaria was the capital of the northern 10 tribes. And Omri and other kings, but Omri especially, had built a capital there, a beautiful capital. And it was up high, and it overlooked a very productive and beautiful valley. And so, in this poetic form here, Isaiah is writing, saying, you know, woe to these leaders and to the capital, you know, which is a symbol for the whole country. Just like, you know, the White House or the Capitol in Washington would be a symbol for the government and leadership of our country. It says, woe to them. And the head of this fertile valley, you know, this capital that's up on the top of this hill and overlooking this beautiful area. But the leaders of Ephraim are described or depicted as being drunken. Does that mean they were always drinking and it was a problem? Well, perhaps, I don't know. You know that. But what's the point here? Maybe they were drunk. Maybe they did drink too much, but they didn't drink. They weren't drunk all the time. But Isaiah is making a point here. He's saying, you know what's really wrong with them is that they think like they're drunk. They don't have good judgment. They might as well be drunk because they can't make a good decision. They are incapable of making a good decision. So they're drunk. And Isaiah is speaking in Jerusalem, and he's speaking to Jews in the southern nation of Judah. And they probably, you know, were in some agreement here. Yeah, those Ephraimites, Israelites, whatever they are, kind of crazy. They might as well be drunk. So, you know, maybe Isaiah is starting this particular section of prophecy with something we can all agree on. That is that the people up north, they don't know what they're doing. And the Jews could say, well, yeah, you're right. We get that. So maybe, you know, maybe it's part of you know, when you want to talk to somebody about something, you like to start on something you agree on. At least we can, and then they'll be listening to you. So Isaiah finds something we can all agree on down in Jerusalem, and that is that the Israelites don't know what they're doing. And perhaps that had already been proven because they may have already been conquered by the Assyrians. And we move on to verse 2. And if you have any questions or comments during this, I'm not going to ask all the time, but just, you know, raise your hand or say something to get my attention. Verse 2. Behold, the Lord has a strong and mighty agent. Now, that word agent isn't in the Hebrew. As a storm of hail, a tempest of destruction, like a storm of mighty overflowing waters. He has cast it down to the earth with his hand. So Israel had received, or was going to receive very shortly, depending on the timing, judgment from two sources. And what are those two sources? Well, it says the Lord has a strong and mighty, and the King James, I think, and the New American Standard, so fill in the word agent. In other words, God's going to do it, but he's going to do it through something or somebody else. You're going to be judged. Israel was judged. And it was judged by who? By God for its sins, and by the Assyrians, who were the agent of God's punishment. And the Assyrians attacked Samaria. They besieged it first, then they attacked it. And who were those agents? Well, you can, I didn't tell you the truth. I'll just refer to 2 Kings 17. I'm not going to go there. But in 2 Kings 17, we can read that Shalmaneser laid siege to Samaria. And what's a siege? Siege is when you surround the city you don't let people have access to their water if the water is outside the city. If you have a source of water in the city, then you seize the city and until people run out of food. You use up all the food that's out. Your army uses up the food that's outside, and you don't let people come out of the city to get their food. And if you recall, and it's still like this in some parts of the world, not so much in the United States, people lived in the city and farmed outside. They didn't necessarily live outside where their farms were. They'd live in the walled city and go out and farm. So when you wanted to conquer a city, you'd go and encircle the city. People couldn't get out to their farms and get the food. And sooner or later, they'd starve, and you'd be able to beat them. So that was a common tactic in warfare back then. And Shalmaneser laid siege to the city, and Sargon II, the king, I guess, he came and took personal control of the army when it was time to conquer, time to move in on Samaria. And they did take the city, and they took exiles out of the city and out of the nation of Israel. So Assyria is the agent. God's the one that's going to judge, or that did judge Israel, but he did it through his agent, if you want to put it that way. Assyria did the dirty work, as it were. And the idea of a storm, a flood, an army being a flood, it's common in the Bible. I will just turn back to Isaiah. It's already been used in Isaiah in chapter 8 and verse 7. So I'll read that. Where we read that, "Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many, even the king of Assyria and all his glory." So, Assyria in the book of Isaiah already has been used or been described as a flood. So the storm, what we read about in verse 2, it's referring to the Assyrians. God's going to judge Israel, and to a certain extent he judged Judah using the Assyrians as his agent, if you want to put it that way. Let's go to verse 3. Verse 3 and 4. "The proud crown of the drunkards of Ephraim is trodden underfoot, and the fading flower of its glorious beauty, which is at the head of the fertile valley, will be like the first ripe fig prior to summer, which one sees, and as soon as it's in his hand, he swallows it." So it's got a lot of poetic language here, right? We're talking about international geopolitics, Isaiah uses an analogy of a fertile farmland overlooked by a capital and a ripe fig, and he's using these analogies that mean something to them because they're an agrarian society. So once again, he's talking about the head of the fertile valley. He's talking about Samaria. And the Assyrians were going to come and treat that area like a first ripe fig. What does that mean? I had to, I think about this a while and look up the commentaries say and so forth. And the idea is, what happened? What point is it making? It says, as soon as it is in his hand, he swallows it. In other words, there's no time lapse here. You just, oh wow, it's good. Eat it right away. And what Assyria was going to do to Israel is going to happen in a hurry. And we're not going to worry about whether it's time yet or whether it's ready. In other words, with this first ripe fig, you're going to pick that and you're going to eat it. You're not going to wait for the harvest season when it's time to harvest all the figs. You can do it right now. So it has to do with the immediacy of God's judgment. And that it's not normal. It's not the regular harvest time. It's not, God, the judgment of the Assyrians is going to be when they're good and ready, which is they're going to pick it and eat it right away. So that's the analogy there. In verse 5, "In that day the Lord of hosts will become a beautiful crown and a glorious diadem to the remnant of his people, a spirit of justice for him who sits in judgment and the strength of those who repel the onslaught at the gate." So when Isaiah uses a term like "in that day," he's talking about something off in the future. And here he's skipping forward, not to just the time of judgment, but even a time and even beyond that. But it makes a point that even in a time of judgment, there's a remnant, and God can be a source of strength for them. Because it says there that a spirit of justice that for him who sits in judgment. So somebody is being judged, but then what's it say after that? A strength to those who repel the onslaught at the gate. So maybe it's God's judgment, and you're kind of stuck in the middle of it. And in this case, you know, you're stuck not because that you're a bad person, but because it's your job to, you know, defend the gate. And it's God's judgment that the Assyrians are going to overrun the capital anyway. And Isaiah's point here is that even in a bad time like that, God is there for you as an individual. You might not be able to control all the circumstances around, you know, but for the guy who's stuck there at the gate, God could be a source of strength for him also, even when the battle is a losing one. You know, God's not necessarily going to give you the victory because you'd like to be on the winning side, but he will give you strength and support and comfort and help even though you're on the losing side. And we all have endured that in our lives. You know, we don't always win all of our battles. The good news is we were going to win the war because Jesus conquered death, right? So that's the good news. In the end, we win. But that does not guarantee a string of wins between now and then. Sometimes you're going to be on the losing side. And even in those bad situations, God is there for you. And as it says, a strength of those who repel the onslaught at the gate. Sometimes we're the recipients of an onslaught. You've all been there. And God's there for you, even when you happen to be in that situation. Verse 7. And these also reel with wine and stagger from strong drink. The priest and the prophet with reel with strong drink. They are confused by wine. They stagger from strong drink. They reel while having visions. They totter when rendering judgment. For all the tables are full of filthy vomit. That's pretty disgusting sounding. Without a single clean place. So here you have a description. And I can't tell you, and you know, I don't know how we can tell for sure. It says, and these also. That's the way it reads in the New American Standard. Let me look at the King James while I'm here. But they also. The New American Standard said these also. It's possible that there's a shift in who's being referred to here. All right, so in other words, Isaiah could be saying, all right, all this stuff happened up in Israel. We've seen it. We've already seen what happened up there. But you know what? Down here, we got the same problem. But sooner or later, it shifts, and it's obvious. And this might be where the shift happens. You know, it could be that Isaiah's already suffered its fate. Israel has already suffered its fate. But Isaiah's point, he can't save Israel, but he's talking to the leaders of Judah. And he's saying, you know, you don't have to do the same thing that Israel did. You don't have to suffer the same fate. Of course, they were going to, and nothing changed. But, you know, that's the job of the prophet to say, God's giving you a warning here. You don't have to go through this. You don't have to do the same thing. So now it seems to me, and some of the commentators, that the tone is shifting, and we're shifting away from Israel and down to Judah. And Isaiah is saying the same thing. Yeah, you thought those guys couldn't make a right decision. Well, we have the same problem here. And I don't know, and you get older in any society, I guess. Sometimes you feel that way about your own society, wherever you live, that sometimes our leaders aren't capable of making a good decision sometimes. I guess the way we get old and cranky and we think, oh, nobody knows what they're doing anymore, and things change. But now we're talking about Judah's leaders. And the word picture is pretty sickening. There's nothing clean at the table. The table's just a mess. They're incapable of making a good choice or a good decision. They can't accomplish anything that's going to help the country. And, you know, judgment is coming. And that's true of any people that can't get their act together and make good decisions for the good of the country. The ability to judge properly has been compromised. Why? Because they're drinking all the time? No, that's not the point. That's an analogy there. Saying it's just like these people might as well be drunk because they can't make a good decision. And that's a problem. So there's nothing new under the sun. You know, governments have had this trouble for thousands of years where sometimes they work and it's good, and sometimes they don't work very well and it's not so good. And I don't know that it matters what kind of a government you have. I was commenting last week, so there was some announcement made about Haiti, where I was, and I related that when I was in Haiti last time, you know, talking to some of the locals, one fellow said, and he's older than I am, and he said, you know, it wasn't so bad under Papa Doc, they called him, Claude Duvalier. And then his son, who they called Baby Doc. They were dictators. Americans were very much against there being a dictatorship down there in Haiti. I don't know what we were worried about. I don't remember all the details back then. But we didn't like the Duvaliers, and we were somewhat supportive of the when they tried to be overthrow them. Now, I'm not saying I support dictatorships. That's not my point. But you know what these people in Haiti were telling me? Well, you know, it was a dictator, but we had gas pumps. We had gas at the gas pumps. They haven't had gas at their gas pumps for the last month, most of the time. They can't go anywhere. The nation is at a standstill. You know, the water came out of the faucet. The electricity ran all day. The electricity doesn't run all day now. So, you know, governments have had trouble for all of man's history. And it doesn't matter whether it's a dictatorship or a democracy or this or that. You know, we don't govern ourselves very well. We'll talk about that at the Feast of Tabernacles. The solution to that is God's government. But I'm not picking on any particular kind of government. You know, I don't want to have to live under a dictatorship, but the Haitians kind of think back, you know, that was pretty good back then. We had food. We could afford to buy food. They have food in Haiti. They just can't afford, the economy's so bad, people have a hard time scrounging up the money to have enough food to eat and to be well nourished. That wasn't a problem, you know, 40 years ago under the Duvalier. So what's my point? My point is not to support dictators. My point is that man doesn't know how to govern himself. And sometimes we think we know better, but we are just like drunks because we're incapable of making good choices and decisions. And that was the problem. And that's the analogy that Isaiah decided to use, he was inspired to use. These, you know, dealing with these people and listening to these people is like listening to a bunch of drunks. Verse 9. To whom would he teach knowledge, and to whom would he interpret the message? Those just weaned from milk? Those taken from the breast? Now, it's not exactly clear who the he is referring to here. But the point is that their talk, you know, why does it say infants just taken from the breast and those just weaned from milk? Well, when you're that age where you're just being weaned, you don't talk too well, do you? You kind of babble and mumble and, you know, goo goo gaga or whatever. And Isaiah, again, he's bringing in a different analogy, but it's the same point. Before he says it's like listening to a bunch of drunks. Now he says it's like baby talk. It's like baby talk. It's gibberish. Doesn't mean much, not much to understand. What's it say there in verse 10? Here's one of the verses that we're all familiar with. I'll read in the King James first. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little, there a little. For with stammering lips and another tongue will I speak to this people. In the New American Standard says, for he says, order on order, order on order, line on line, line on line, a little here, a little there. Indeed, he will speak to the people through stammering lips and a foreign tongue. In Hebrew, and I don't speak Hebrew and I can't pronounce it well. In Hebrew, when you read those things where it says precept upon precept, rule upon rule, whatever, however you want to translate it, they're simple little tiny words. It's kind of like blah, blah, blah. Just little monosyllabic words. It's not quite like blah, 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 because at least there's some meaning. In Hebrew, everything, every root of a word has some kind of a meaning somehow or another. So even though they're little short root words, there's a meaning attached. And if you want to say it in English now, maybe a way of saying it, all you say is law, law, rule, rule, rule. What, you know, who are we, school children? You got to talk to us like a first grade teacher? You just say, you know, you're saying the same thing again and again. You're making it very simple. Isaiah seems to be saying to these Jews down there in Jerusalem, why do you want to listen to these people? They're talking gibberish. It's like an infant. It's just, you know, at the breast. It's just an infant that's nursing. Or like somebody's going, blah, 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 blah. You know, they're not making any sense. It's like a bunch of drunks talking. In fact, some translators would argue, and I would argue, that it would be better here rather than saying line upon line, precept upon precept, and so forth. You just transliterate it. And if you did, this is what it would say. It'd say something that I don't speak Hebrew, so I can't say that I'm pronouncing this right at all. But it would be something like saw, saw, gaw, gaw, tever, tever. You know, it's just some kind of just easy to say things that don't say a whole lot. Unintelligible. Because it says with what's that, stammering lips? Stammering lips in a foreign tongue. What's that mean? That means it sounds like you don't even know what you're saying, and plus I can't understand you. Foreign tongue, you know, we can't understand. I've got guys that work for me who speak Spanish, and I don't understand them. They have to translate for me. So, you know, I deal with that every day. I don't know what they're saying. They have to, sometimes it's, with a couple of them, when I don't have somebody there that does know English and Spanish both, we got to use a lot of hand motions and, he'll go show me, whatever. What it means is you can't understand them. Now, it's not clear, and we weren't there when Isaiah wrote it, we weren't at, you know, is he mocking them? Is Isaiah mocking them? He might be. He might be saying, you know, these guys are just going mob. They're going blah, 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 blah. You know, it's gibberish. He might be making fun of them. But in any event, he's saying, you know, they're not saying much. They're just saying, it's like they're talking to a five-year-old. You got to dumb it down. They think we're stupid, whatever. In verse 12, he says, he who said to them, here is rest, give me rest, give rest to the weary, and here is repose, but they would not listen. So, you know, God had offered them a way that would work. God said, you can stay in the land if you just obey me. But they wouldn't obey. Israel already, you know, in trouble, and Judah to be in trouble soon. So the word of the Lord, verse 13, to them will be, order on order, order on order, line on line, here a little and there a little, that they may go and stumble backward and be broken and snared and taken captive. So there it is again, line upon, in King James, line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. So what's the point here? Isaiah is saying, if this is what you want to listen to, you can listen to it from somebody that you really can't understand, like the Assyrians, because you can't speak their language. Or better, you know, eventually by the time Judah was conquered, it was the Babylonians. Then you really will have to hear it from somebody you can't understand that's talking to you in another language. And they're going to talk to you like five-year-olds, because they're going to tell you to go here, go there, do this, do that. And you're going to have to listen, because you're captives. Is that what you want? So that was the warning. You already are like, you know, you're, maybe, you know, maybe there's a bit of mockery going on here. Maybe they thought that Isaiah was kind of lecturing them like a five-year-old, like they were five-year-olds. And they give it back to him. Well, Isaiah says, yeah, you're going to be talked to just like that. From people that you can't understand, because you'll be in captivity. So God had promised them rest. God had promised them peace in the land if they would obey. They wouldn't obey. What's the result? The result was going to be captivity. He the Assyrians, the Babylonians, eventually the Persians, before some of them were able to come back to Jerusalem and rebuild. So their mocking was going to come true. They were going to be on the receiving end of this kind of talk. Now, the next section is interesting to me for several reasons, and we'll spend a little time on it. Not a long time. I'm not going to go through every verse in a lot of detail, but starting in verse 14, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem? Because you have said, therefore hear the word of the Lord, O scoffers, who rule this people who are in Jerusalem. So I'll interrupt myself right there. So he's, you know, now it's clear. I think before it was true, but now we have no doubt. Isaiah is identifying who he's talking to. He's talking to scoffers, people who aren't believing what he's saying and are making fun of him. And he's saying that these people are the leaders in Jerusalem. So they are the leaders of Judah, the nation of Judah. So now he's making, you know, it's very clear who he's talking to. And I think he's already been talking to them. But now it's clear. Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made a pact. The overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by. For we have made falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I'm laying in Zion a stone, a tested stone. Here's another one you're familiar with. Right? A costly cornerstone for the foundation, firmly placed. He who believes in it will not be disturbed. I will make justice the measuring line, and righteousness the level. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and the waters will overflow the secret place. Your covenant with death will be canceled, and your pact with Sheol will not stand when the overwhelming scourge passes through. Then you become as a trampling place. You become its trampling place, sorry. As often as it passes through, it will seize you. From morning after morning, it will pass through any time during the day or night, and it will be sheer terror to understand what it means. I don't know if any of you noticed that in your Bible, but especially if it's written in a verse form, that's some Hebrew parallelism that I've pointed out in other sermons in the past. Inverse. It's not inverse parallelism, but it's parallelism. And what's that mean? It means it deals with something A, B, C, D, and then it comes back A, B, C, D, goes through them again. That's a very Hebrew way of writing. And it's a form of Hebrew poetry. Excuse me. So Isaiah recognizes that there's always going to be scoffers. He knows these people aren't listening to him. And he calls them scoffers. And remember when we were talking about inverse parallelism before, I used it with the Jesus parable when he's in Simon's house. The story there in Simon's house with the woman that washes feet and so forth. The most important point is in the middle. And here we have an example of that. In verse 15 it says, you said we've made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we've made a pact, and the overwhelming scourge will not reach us when it passes by. For we have made falsehood our refuge, and we have concealed ourselves with deception. And then if you go down to verse 18, we read, your covenant with death will be canceled, and your pact with Sheol will not stand, and when the overwhelming scourge passes through, and then you become its trampling place, and is off. In verse 17, you had to start there. Then hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and waters will overflow the secret place. So you have this parallelism. Each one, you know, it's stated. And then we come back and we address each of those points in turn. But the important point is in the middle. The most important point, and that is, I'll read it in the King James because we're more familiar with it that way. Behold, I lay in Zion a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believes shall not make haste or... will not be disturbed, it says in the New American Standard. So here we have a reference, of course, we know, to the future, to the Messiah, because that verse is quoted in the New Testament, and it refers to Jesus, that the builders rejected the stone which God provided. Just right in the middle of that parallelism. So it's an important point. But it's a forward-looking point. It's not referring to the immediate situation there in Judah at the time. It's interesting, I think, that it says, and this goes back to what I'm saying, is nothing new under the sun. Falsehood is our refuge. Falsehood is our refuge. In other words, you know, we can't handle the truth. And sometimes as you know, we have that problem when we in our own country sometimes, you know, we can't agree on whether this paper is white or black. So we can't even get started on a conversation because we don't agree on the facts. And that's sad to me. But it's nothing new. You know, Isaiah's saying it was that way 2,700 years ago, that people make their refuge in falsehood. So we can't even agree on what the facts are to have a conversation about it. There is such a thing as truth, but in decaying situations, and that's what you had in Israel, and that's what you had in Judah, where civility was decaying and the country was decaying and sin was becoming the norm for everybody, nobody seems to know what the truth is anymore. And when Isaiah speaks the truth, people don't want to hear it. They'd rather hear the gibberish from their leaders that are talking like they're drunk or talking like they're babbling like a baby or babbling like a first grade, you know, school teacher. Not that a first grade school teacher babbles, but you know what I mean? Communicating like somebody's very young and can't comprehend things that are complicated. Sometimes we'd rather do that than face the truth and face facts. In this case, probably what's being referred to is the fact that the Jews wanted to trust Egypt for their salvation. Why? Because Egypt's down there to the south and Assyria's to the north. And, you know, if we ally ourselves with Egypt, Egypt will take care of us and push the Assyrians away from us. Well, that doesn't happen. It doesn't happen because Egypt historically did not care about Israel and Judah. They were just what we call buffer states, right? Russia does that today. They like, we all like to have a buffer state. Russia's got the stands down on the south end, and they had for years in the USSR, they had Eastern Europe that was a barrier between them and France and Italy and Germany and Britain and so forth. So you feel a little bit safer if you got all these people in between you and the people you might perceive as your enemy. Well, that's the way the Egyptians treated Israel and Judah. The Egyptians made pacts with them in different times. Later on, it happens again with the Ptolemies. It's later on in time. But the bottom line is that the Egyptians don't care about the Jews. They didn't care about the Israelites. And Isaiah is warning them. So they don't care about you. They don't care about us. And don't put your faith in them. Put your faith in God. And God offers protection again. God is the cornerstone, not Egypt, not some other nation of the earth that you put your trust in. God's the cornerstone. Of course, that's quoted in the New Testament, it refers to the Messiah. So it's just an interesting set of verses here with some parallelism, an important point in the middle, and in my opinion, some interesting comments about the battle between truth and lies that has characterized man's entire existence on the earth. We can't, you know, we don't value the truth enough, and it's always caused us trouble. Verse 22. I love this too. For the bed is too short on which to stretch out, and the blanket's too small to wrap oneself in. For the Lord will rise up as at Mount Perazim. He will be stirred up as in the valley of Gibeon to do his task, his unusual task, and to work his work, his extraordinary work. And now do not carry on as scoffers. You know, stop this. Stop scoffing. Or your fetters will be made stronger. For I have heard from the Lord God of hosts of decisive destruction on all the earth. Isaiah is again warning them, don't put your trust in Egypt. Put your trust in God. If you put your trust in Egypt, it's going to be like being short-sheeted. Has anybody ever been short-sheeted? You know, somebody come in and change your linens around so that you get into bed and you put your feet down and you can't go down because somebody wrapped your sheet up. That's saying the sheet isn't big enough. The bed's not big enough. You know, Egypt isn't big enough to protect you. It's just like being short-sheeted. God's ways work, but they aren't necessarily what you might think. And that's with the rest, and we'll just read through it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time here. In verses 23 to 29. Give ear. Hear my voice. Listen and hear my words. Does the farmer plow continually to plant seed? You know, in other words, the farmer plow all year long? No. Does he continually turn and harrow the ground? No. Does he not level its surface and sow dill and scatter cumin and plant wheat and rows, barley in its place and rye within its area? For his God instructs and teaches him properly, for dill is not threshed with a threshing sledge, nor is the cartwheel driven over cumin. But dill is beaten out with a rod and cumin with a club, and grain for bread is crushed. Indeed, he does not continue to thresh it forever. Because the wheel of the cart and his horses eventually damage it, he doesn't thresh it any longer. This also comes from the Lord of hosts, who made his counsel wonderful and his wisdom great. Why we have a little excursion here into agriculture? Because God does things when they need to be done and in a way that works, just like a farmer does. A farmer doesn't do the same thing with every crop because it doesn't work for every crop. You have to do one thing with one crop, one thing with another crop. You don't harvest them all the same. You don't plant them all the same. You don't plant all year long. You don't harvest all year long. There's a time and a place to do everything you do as a farmer. And in an agrarian society, that made sense. Everybody can understand that. And Isaiah is applying this to God. You trust God, and God will take care of things. He'll do it the way it's good to take care of it. You might not be able to figure it out. You just got to do what God says. You have to trust him. When he says, I want you to trust me, I don't want you to go to Egypt, you don't go to Egypt. You don't have to figure it out for yourself. You don't have to somehow come to your own conclusions when God has already given you the answer. And in that sense, it's no different than a farmer. Trust in his judgment. You know, don't try to second guess. Don't second guess a farmer. A farmer knows what he's doing. He's been educated on how to work the land. Well, God's been educated on how to work things in the world. We don't need to second guess him. So Isaiah had a message for the Jews of his day. And that message was, overall, in this whole chapter, to trust in God. Not in Egypt, not in anybody else, no men. And that message applies today. Not that we are tempted to trust in Egypt, but that we need to trust God. And whatever our particular situation is, whatever is going perhaps bad in our lives, maybe we're the last one there defending the gate right now while it's under attack. But God will be there for us, that's what he says. And people that want to argue otherwise are speaking gibberish. People that want to say blah, 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 goo, 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 whatever, don't pay attention to them. It's gibberish. Now, why did I pick this chapter? Well, maybe you figured, it's obvious to you. Because of verse 10 and verse 13. I grew up in a culture where those verses were used as a justification or reason. I'll put it this way, and I could show you a place, they were used and they still are being used by many people. Maybe some people in this room, I don't mean to offend anybody. If you disagree with me, that's fine. But I feel strongly about this. When we read, for precept must be upon precept, line upon line, and here a little, there a little, I can show you right now places where teachers with a lot more experience and knowledge than me, I think, will tell you that that's a formula for how to study the Bible. Well, Isaiah didn't say that. Isaiah said, it's like listening to a bunch of drunks. It's an entirely different, that's why I thought it was interesting to look at the context here. It gives it an entirely different meaning. I'm not saying that we don't read the entire Bible, and there is a little bit here, a little bit there. That's not my point one way or the other. But in my experience, and maybe yours, we have been guilty, I've been guilty, of knowing what it was I wanted to prove, and so I go here and grab this one, and I go here and grab this one, and I go here and grab that one. And I say, look, it proves it. Now, what's the problem with that? I mean, those verses say what they say, right? But we take them out of context. And we're maybe ignoring a whole bunch of other verses that might give us a different approach. Because you've got to read the whole book. Now, I've spoken about that over the years. You've got to read the whole book and get what the whole book's telling you. Can't decide, I just want to believe this, and I can show you because this one, and this one say it's got to be so. Meanwhile, you know, other people say, well, yeah, but it says this over here, and it says this over here. And then what's the answer? That you, if you ever, maybe you've been in these discussions, maybe you haven't, but I have. I say, well, this, and this is why I believe. And I say, well, you know, this commentator says this, or this is a way of looking at this, and I bring out something else. And you get the answer, and you've probably heard this, and I'm not picking on anybody who says it. I've heard it plenty of times. Well, they don't have the Spirit. How do we know they know what they're talking about? Okay, so we know and they don't. Well, I think you're taking a risk when you think like that. I'm not saying you think like that. I'm not picking on anybody, but my suggestion is read the whole book, always, and consider what the entire counsel of the Bible is, not necessarily just a few verses. And don't use verses like Isaiah 28:10 and Isaiah 28:13 as a justification for cherry-picking. That's one term we use. Another is proof texting. Cherry-picking or proof texting. In other words, taking the things that you want to take to prove what you want to believe. Are you guilty of that? I have no idea. I know I've been guilty of it. And I know I've been taught that that's actually the way to do it. I don't believe that anymore, and that's why I'm sharing that. Got to be careful. That's a whole lesson here, too, of Isaiah 28. What's the main point? Isaiah's main point all the way through the chapter is be careful who you put your trust in. It better be God. Better be God. Not any man or any, you know, man's systems. So don't trust in men, you and me. The lesson still applies today. Don't trust in men, trust in God. The world's becoming more and more hostile to God's way, and we're aware of that. And we won't find safety in a man or any group of men or any nation of men like Egypt back in those days. Don't be fooled by the babble. Don't be fooled by the gibberish. Don't be fooled by the simple talk if they're not speaking God's words. Gibberish will not save you, but God will. Put your faith in the cornerstone because it is rock solid. He is rock solid, I should say.